You are listening to episode 13 of the GNU World Order, season 7. Hi everyone, this is episode 13 of season 7. My name's Klaatu, this is the GNU World Order. It's April 1st, aka April Fool's Day, so I'm sorry that there's not a brilliant and clever joke associated with this episode, especially given that it's episode 13 of all numbers, but I just didn't have anything planned, I didn't see this coming, so no jokes, no fooling, just normal show. We do have a lot of listener feedback, and there's just no way I'm going to be able to cover it all. It's gotten way out of control. People need to stop emailing me so much. Stop being so friendly, everyone. No, actually, thank you for being so friendly. Thank you for emailing me. I really appreciate the emails. I love talking to new people, meeting people, you know, the whole people thing. So let's see, there's a couple of people who've emailed me, quite a few people, Bob and Dale and Core and probably a few other people that I'm just not thinking of off the top of my head. Deep Geek as well. They emailed me their GPG key. Some of them encrypted their messages. It was really cool, and it really gave me a chance to really give the Mutt integration a test drive. And it works seamlessly. It's unbelievable. It's so neat. As long as you've imported in Mutt their GPG key, you know, you just do a GPG space dash dash search dash keys dash dash key server space pgp.mit.edu or whatever key server you use, and then their name or their email or something like that, some identifying piece of information. You find their key, you import it into your system, your GNU PG keychain, and then you fire up Mutt. If they've encrypted a message to you, then you've got their key in your keychain, you just open it, and it just decrypts it. It's completely transparent. It's really, really nice. Going back out as an encrypted message, it is as easy. It's not totally transparent because you have to turn it on, obviously. But so when you go out to Mutt, you're emailing them, you know, you're typing your message, and you save the message, come back into Mutt, you just hit, when you're at the sending the email screen, like where you can make those last changes before you actually send the email, you hit P, as in privacy, and it brings up the GNU PG options down in the bottom, the little mini buffer, and you can sign it, you can encrypt it, you can sign and encrypt it, and then you can send it that way, and it does everything it's supposed to do, you know, encrypts your message with their public key and sends the message. So it's really brilliant. I have to say it's really cool. There were a couple of little snags, not in Mutt, not in GNU PG, just the way that we were doing things. Some people had like two keys, or someone had maybe encrypted it for someone else, you know, I mean, there were just little oddities that we just kind of went back and forth and said, you know, hey, this didn't work in Mutt, I had to download the message, or rather, you know, save the message out of Mutt, and then I had to run it through GPG manually, or whatever the case, but it was a great test run, really, and certainly if things get bad, I'll have at least four or five people to talk to privately, so good for us. Let's see, what else? Well, there was Christian from Europe sent me an email. And frankly, I felt it was kind of a brilliant email. It really doesn't deserve to be listener feedback. It deserves to be kind of incorporated, I think, into some other thing. I don't know what. I mean, it really, honestly, it read like a manifesto to me. And so I'm going to read it. And this is Christian from Europe. I don't know what else to call him, really. And this is his, I guess, I don't really know what it is. It's just a good manifesto. So actually, he's from London. I don't know. That I didn't know that before. I thought he was in Europe proper. But oh well, whatever. Christian, manifesto begins now. These are his words. Almost all people have the capacity to understand basic logic/reasoning, and given how obvious it is that there is terrible suffering in the world, there is a moral imperative to seek to understand and mitigate problems. This is basically the hacker ethic. That was point one. This is point two. A little bit of knowledge significantly lowers the barriers of entry for many computer users, especially small server website, multimedia production, and even word processing. The user only gains this knowledge by using simple approaches. I don't have a computer science degree, but that's that sort of thing. That's the second point. Third point, there is no level of automated protection that can mitigate every human error. If you install binaries on your PC without being certain of the provenance, you can never claim to be secure. In a networked world, the problem increases exponentially. The Tenido plug defaults to serve your personal data to the world over an unencrypted connection using an unsupported Ubuntu install that runs entirely as root. Given that Tenido would never state this in their marketing or the user manual, I had to rely on my self-taught GNU Linux knowledge to understand my Tenido plug and never switch it on again. Point 4. Introduction of code for no purpose involves taking risks with no possible benefit. Many websites need 2 megabytes of HTML on a static page, but run 30 megabytes of PHP with all kinds of plugins that the user doesn't even understand or need. Point 5, and final, it is inevitable that a computer user will need to intervene when something doesn't work. Problem is that if the user knows nothing, they end up going onto the Ubuntu forum and cutting and pasting sudo rm-frf/ into a terminal thinking that it will install MS Core fonts. That was his message to me. It was obviously in response to sort of my musings about, oh, people need to understand this, people don't need to understand that, all that kind of stuff. I just thought that was a brilliant set of points. I mean, some of them are just so important. I mean, the understanding of the hacker ethic, or sort of the definition of what that is. I mean, we've all had definitions of the hacker ethic, but I think this is kind of neat. You know, it's kind of cool to hear the hacker ethic applied really to a worldwide thing, a moral imperative to seek to understand and mitigate problems. That's really cool to me. That's a lot cooler than the hacker ethic is I like puzzles. You know? I mean, that's just kind of neat. I'd never heard it really put that way. And then just the sort of thing, a little bit of knowledge significantly lowers the barrier of entry. It's so true. I mean, it's no joke. It's totally true. It doesn't take much to get started on the computer. You just have to get over that hump of, oh, I don't know computers, or whatever. There's no level of automated protection. That's a great point. Introduction of code for no purpose is dangerous. That's a great point. And it's inevitable that a computer user will need to intervene when something doesn't work. Again, great point. And this is something that I was just musing about last week. I had this very, very locked down platform that I was dealing with. It was someone else's computer. They needed it fixed. The thing is so locked down by the manufacturer that there's no way to fix it. You know, I mean, there's like this mentality from this manufacturer that, well, if we simplify and lock everything down to the extreme, then it will never get hacked into. And the flip side of that is, well, yeah, and then when it breaks, then it's not going to be fixable either, and that's pretty much been true. So all of this stuff is just really, really, I guess, apropos. So great comment, Christian. Thank you very much from London. Victor Velez wrote me and asked me if I'd ever done anything with LVM snapshots. Nope, haven't. If I do, I will let you guys know. Someone else had emailed me Core. That was it. Core from, I think, the Netherlands, and he was initially, and I don't remember if I gave you guys the history of this or not, but he was originally emailing me to see if I really thought that Google was a good idea or a bad idea, and I think it was an honest question. I don't think he was like sort of, I don't think it was rhetorical, because we had a really good conversation about it, and I'd read you all the emails, except I think we'd run out of time, but we talked about it. And he ultimately decided that, yeah, Google was not for him. He wanted to just try to replicate as much of that ease and simplicity that Google does provide, at least from what I hear. I don't honestly use enough of the Google services to truly know what it provides at this point. But I can imagine it's very simple. It's probably everything is drop in, I'm sure. And so he wanted to replicate that. And it sounds like he's found like a number of really cool things to kind of get away from Google and yet have that same kind of convenience that he would want by using Google. He mentioned PyWiki or PyWik, PIWIK.org. I didn't know it was a statistic type of thing, but I guess he said it was a nice replacement for Google statistics. I have not responded to him about that yet, so I don't know the details. Might be something to check out. Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot out there now. Love it or hate it, the quote-unquote cloud, you know, those cloud services, that sort of feel of, oh, I'm going to have something running, you know, remotely. There's a lot of stuff out there. I've been doing a lot of stuff with Git, which is actually one of our topics today, and it just, every time I use it, I'm just amazed at the fact that I own the whole stack, essentially, and that I don't have to really rely on anyone else to have the amount of power that this simple little program of Git gives me. So finally, Bert emailed me, and Bert says that he's going to start mirroring, or I guess really serving the contributing, I guess, to the torrent stream of the Multimedia Sprint version 1, volume 1. I haven't forgotten about Multimedia Sprint. I have to admit, I use it almost every day. It's something that I just use nonstop. It's so invaluable. Again, I have to thank everyone who helped me on it, and there will be a second one, I promise, and probably a third one. I just have to get... it's on my schedule to be scheduled. It's just not scheduled yet, so it will be around. But thank you to everyone who helped find all that stuff, because I've been one of the prime users of it, I think. And thank you for everyone who is either hosting it or torrenting it or sort of some combination of both. And if you ever want to look through the Sprint without downloading the whole 2 gigabyte file, you can always go to the Delwyn Mirror. He has a really cool... Delwyn's the guy who runs the Kernel Panic Ogcast phone system, or like the Mumble server. And he's got this cool sort of broken out version of it where you can just go in and download individual files. It's really, really nice. And I'll put the link for that in the... That's the skyhaven.net link, but I'll put the link in the show notes. Okay, I think that's not all the listener feedback, but that's, I think, all we're going to get to right now. So thank you for emailing, and keep listening and keep emailing, and I'll keep emailing you. And if I didn't mention you on the show, it's not, of course, because I don't like you. It's just because we probably are emailing anyway, and it might be either redundant or repetitive or just too complex to try to relay over the show and try to catch people up. So those were the ones that kind of I thought were good for general consumption. So let's move on to Git. I lied. Let's not get on to Git yet. Let's do one more thing, and that is the QTractor user manual has been updated by yours truly. I've written about 99 pages, letter-sized pages, of how to use QTractor. It's a full manual for everything in QTractor, almost. Honestly, there's so much in QTractor, some of it I don't even use. And I didn't feel comfortable about writing about something that I didn't really understand. I didn't want to do one of those, well, in theory, this is how it will work, although I haven't actually tested it. But everything that I did write, I've tested to some degree, either a lot or on occasion, and it is very, very complete. It covers everything you will probably need, from audio to MIDI to inserts, sends and aux sends and returns, effects, what a compressor does, what an EQ does, what a low pass filter is, what a high pass filter is, how reverb sort of works. I mean, I don't go into the physics of it or anything, but I mean, I'm talking about the different attributes that you can change on the reverb plugins. Just everything you can think of. How to import sound, export the final mix, tips on mixing, limiters, just, I mean, you name it. It talks about all kinds of stuff. So I honestly think it's a pretty nifty little book. So if you're thinking about using QTractor or you're interested in using QTractor, go on over to qtractor.sourceforge.net and look in the documentation folder for the QTractor manual. Don't do it just this minute, because I'm actually making a couple of minor changes to it that the developer has told me, you know, either some things are outdated or some things just don't really maybe fit into what he would call a QTractor manual. So I'm making a couple of little updates. I want to dress it up a little bit, but pretty, you know, any day now there's going to be a really nice version of it on the QTractor site. Since I wrote it, it's a GNU free documentation license, so feel free to obviously distribute it, change it, whatever. The sources, I didn't really have anywhere to put the sources because I don't have SVN access to the QTractor, SVN repository, code repository. So, which makes sense, you know, I mean, I don't know if I was a programmer, I would want a documentation person pushing commits to my repository either. So what I am ending up doing, and this has turned out really for the best, I think, is I'm going to be maintaining the code as a part of Slacker Media, or the code, the book, the docbook sources. I'm going to be maintaining that as part of Slacker Media. So Slacker Media has just grown basically to about double its original size. It's used to be about, I don't know, I'll just say 99 pages, maybe actually 120 or so. And I've rolled into Slacker Media as sort of a second part of Slacker Media, the full user manual on QTractor, and a really good set of Kdian Live how-tos as well that I wrote, about 30 pages of that. So it's Slacker Media as a volume is about 282 pages now, and the first part is all Slacker Media, how to build your system. The second or third part will be either Kdian Live or QTractor and vice versa, and that'll be Slacker Media. So if you want the QTractor manual sources, you can just do a git clone of gatorius.org/slackermedia/slackermedia.git, and that will get you everything. And again, don't do that right this moment, because I'm kind of updating some of the README files and stuff like that to try to make them up to date, and I did a couple of things with Publican. I ditched Publican, but I stole the Publican XSL sheets, style sheets, and some of their common content, so I kind of get all the pretty benefits of Publican without having to deal with all the Perl dependencies. Nothing wrong with Perl, but honestly, on installing Publican, that was a real chore. And kind of conforming to the way that Publican wants me to do it was starting to kind of cramp my style. I wanted to do things a little bit differently, so I'm just back to using straight-up DocBook with XSLT proc and FOP for PDF. And, of course, you don't need FOP for EPUB, so who cares? So, yeah, that's the news on Slacker Media and on QTractor Manual. So pretty soon here, you can check that out. So, of course, my book, Slacker Media and the QTractor Manual and the Kdian Live content that I wrote, all that stuff is actually vaguely related to this next topic, and the next topic is Git. And I say that they're related because I actually manage each of those via Git. Originally it was independently, Slacker Media was on Gatorius. The QTractor manual, I just had a local install of Git and was managing the versioning just locally on a random server. And the same for the Kdian Live sources. And I'm doing the same thing with a website that I'm building for a friend. So lots of different things can be managed with Git, and they can either be done on Gatorius, or I guess if you want to go GitHub, you could do that, although Gatorius has a fully free stack from top to bottom. Everything's free software, open, the whole nine yards. GitHub, I'm not so sure about. I think I read somewhere that it wasn't, and that's why I didn't go that route, but that's just FYI. Point being, you can do that. You can go to a public server, a public provider of Git services, and sign up with them. And, you know, there's paid and free options and all that other good stuff. Both of them have the sort of social networking or social coding thing kind of built in. So lots of different options. But part of the power of Git is how easy it is to set up. I was flat out shocked when I found out how easy it was to set up a Git repository on a local server and version control whatever you want to with it. It's really, really neat. So someone was asking me about this, and I think I even mentioned this person last week. Could that possibly be? I don't know. But anyway, someone was asking about it, and in IRC, and I said, well, I will refer you to an article that I used to set this up, and I did that, and I will refer you, dear listener, to that as well, www.ibm.com/developerworks/web/library/wa-git. But there's almost no need to go to the trouble of going to that website, actually. It's just really, really simple. So let's go through it together. And if you don't know Git, don't worry. I'm going to kind of give you a really quick... I mean, I've done this before, but I can give you kind of a quick overview of it right now. But first, let's set it up, and then we'll go over some of the basic commands. So obviously, for this exercise, you need two things. I mean, you need a server and a client. Now, in theory, your server doesn't really have to be any different than your client. You could have your little Git repository over, you know, in another folder or something, but I think it would make more sense if it was on a separate, a different physical machine. So, the cool thing about this, again, if you're not really really familiar with this sort of thing, it doesn't, you know, when I say server, you don't have to imagine a big iron power IBM server that is as tall as a small person. That doesn't have to be a server. It can be your laptop sitting over there on that desk while you're on your laptop over on this side of the room. You know, as long as you're on the same network, that's pretty much all you need. So for me, I have an old G4, of course, running in a couple of different places. And so I've been using one of those as my sort of local Git repository. That doesn't really work when I'm out and about, obviously, but it doesn't matter because I don't need to push and pull that often. And if I really, really did, I could probably find a way around all of that stuff. So it's not that big of a deal. And of course, if you really want a completely world-facing Git repository and you don't have a server available to yourself, like I say, signing up for Gitorious.org is completely free. They give you plenty of space, and you can Git via SSH, and it works really, really well. Okay, so on the server, whatever it may be, whether it's your laptop or your desktop or a proper server, whatever, you need to do two things as kind of a setup thing. We need to Git config something to two different values. I guess it should go without saying that you would need Git running on this machine. And it's not like SSH where you need a Git client and a Git server application. You just download Git, install Git, and you're good to go. Okay, so the first command, it would be Git space config space dash dash global space user.name space and then quotes and then whatever name you want to show up as your Git user. So when you commit changes and things like that, this will be the person it says is making that commit. I put Klaatu close quote, and that's just my human readable name that will appear next to all of my commits. After that runs, you can do another one. It's Git space config space dash dash global space user.email space Klaatu at hackerpublicradio.org. And that just sets the email for this user. Just a nice way to make sure that you're being seen by each system as the same person and so on. So then you want to, we need to make a folder that is going to be our Git repository. Apparently, naming the directory that is going to be your Git repository, it's not a bad idea to end it with a .git. And it's not necessary, you can do anything you want, but I guess the .git extension is kind of being adopted. Again, I gather as an unofficial official way of identifying something as a Git repository. So if you ever wanted to migrate this to, say, GitHub or Gitorious or something like that, it'd be a little bit easier to do that because you're already following the conventions that they're using. So make dir, mkdir, space codes-.git, for instance. Okay, now you can cd space exclamation mark dollar sign. That will cd you into the argument of your previous command. And then git space dash dash bare, B-A-R-E, space init. And what that command does, now that you're in your little Git repository, you're initializing a bare Git repository, an empty repository. Git space dash dash bare, B-A-R-E, space init. That'll happen pretty much instantly. You can pwd, at least I always do, because I need to see where I am for myself, because we're about to start talking to this thing from another computer. So I do a pwd, and sure enough, it'll tell me, you know, I'm in /home/2/code/codes-.git. And you're set up. You've just set up Git on your server. You have created a Git server, amazingly enough. Okay, so now if you get off of that server, back onto your client, and if you're doing this in a terminal and you just SSH'd into that server, then really remember to exit. One time I had created the repository. I guess I got out of that folder. I must have walked away or something, came back and started doing stuff. Took me like a good 20 minutes to figure out that I was staring at an SSH terminal into my server and that I was thinking it was my client computer. It was pretty embarrassing. So here we are on our client, right? Little laptop or whatever we're on. And we're gonna clone our empty repository, strange as that may seem. And in fact, Git will even make it seem stranger because it's going to warn you about it. But it's all very normal. So go to wherever you want this repository clone to be. So if it's if I'm building a website, for instance, and versioning controlling it, then maybe I would go into /home/Klaatu/sites/codes-.git. I don't know why I'd be calling a site codes-, but let's just pretend. So I would go into my sites folder or wherever, and I would say git, or actually I would type git space clone space 192.168.1.4 colon slash home slash clat2 slash code slash code stash dot git, right? So that is going to pull the admittedly empty repository from the server and clone it locally for you. And Git will warn you. It will say you've, for some reason, just cloned an empty repository. But that's okay. So then you want to cd into code stash. So now you're in your little empty repository. And now you would do whatever you need to do. Like you would either start building your site or building your code. Or if you'd already started and so you already had files that you'd started and now you want to bring into version control, then you would move them into this folder. So you might do an mv space tilde slash cool new website and just move cool new website, all the files in there, to right here into our code stash. So, you know, you'd get your index, your stylesheet.css, your images folder, your JS folder, whatever. You get all this stuff now in your empty repository. Or, like I say, if you don't have anything, then you could just create a new file. And if you want to do that right now, you could do that. Just echo, quote, your code goes here, close quote, pipe it into, or redirect rather, it into a new file called, I don't know, newfile.txt. So now you've got something in your repository. But do you really? Well, no, not yet. And you can find out what's going on with Git by simply issuing the command git status. And it will tell you that you've now got an untracked file in your repository, or a set of untracked files in your repository. So when a file's untracked, it means that it's not being version controlled. It's in your Git repository, but Git doesn't know it exists. So to tell Git that a file exists and that you want it to know that it exists and you want it to start versioning, controlling that file, then you do a git add. So git space add and then the name of the file will add that file to a little list that Git will keep track of for you of stuff that you want to start version controlling. So if it's just my new file .txt, then I could just do git add my new file .txt. Now if I just moved a whole bunch of stuff in and I didn't want to sit there and type git add such and such, git add such and such, git add, you know, you do it over and over, you can just do a git space add space dot, and that will add everything that is not added in that directory now. It will add it. Git automatically ignores certain hidden directories such as .git, and there's a way to have it ignore other things as well, but we don't really care about that right now. So git adding dot will add everything that is untracked right now in that current directory to your list. Okay, so now you've added stuff to Git, but all you've done is kind of, you've flagged things. They haven't actually been truly approved for something that's going to go to the Git server. For that, you need to do a git commit. Now, this isn't the big commit. Like, this isn't the commit that pushes it to the server. This is something different. This is more like taking everything that's been flagged as trackable, and now you're committing it. You know, you're flagging it to actually be pushed, but you're not pushing it yet. So, git space commit, by default, commits everything in your little add list. Again, there's a way to be able to add but not commit it yet. You can put it in a stat, you can stash it and kind of save things for later, but I don't want to get into that right now. So git space commit will simply take everything that you've told git to add, and it kind of locks it in. It gives everything SHA sums and things like that, and it gives you the opportunity to type in a message, like a commit message. Defaults over to Vim, I think, or actually Vi, and then you can type in your little message, save it, close it, and now you've made a commit, but once again, you haven't actually pushed anything yet. Okay, so this is your first push into an empty repository. The first time you commit, you need to do it very specifically, and that is git space push space origin space master. That means that you are doing your initial commit. You're taking new data and pushing it into an empty repository, and you're establishing what branch you're going to be working on, and that this is the master branch. From now on, like if you go in, and in fact you could do this right now, so if you do git space push space origin space master, It should ask you for a password to get onto the server, and then you'll type that in, and then it will push everything. It will tell you, yes, you've just made your initial commit, and now you're good. You're now version controlled. So now go into your new file and make some changes, like type some stuff or erase some stuff. Do whatever you want to do. Now, if you want to commit those changes, you can do git add, the name of that file, git commit, type in a little message, save it, and now all you do is git push. You don't have to do git push origin master, it's just git push. There will be other, if you're doing multiple branches of stuff, there would be times where you would need to specify what branch you want to push and stuff like that, or merge. Lots of different scenarios, obviously, a lot of power behind all of this, but generally speaking, if you're just using it to version control your own data, that's all you'll be doing is git add, git commit, git push. All right, now let's try something crazy. Well, actually, let's do this. Do a git log, git space log, and that will show you all of the commits that have happened so far. So you'll see your initial commit, you'll see your second commit, whatever else you've done. That shows you the log. You can look at the log. You can look at the difference between logs, like between branches, all kinds of cool things. Again, not in this tutorial, but it's a powerful thing to kind of see where everything is in its lifespan, what's been pushed, what's not been pushed, stuff like that. But this is really cool now. So go into your file and just really mess it up. You know, just erase everything or echo one into your new file. You know, I mean, if there's anything in it, you know, just clear it out completely. Ruin that file. Totally ruin it. That would be, and you could even save it. Ruin it and then save it. That would be bad, right? In real life, that would be a very, very bad thing. You would be bummed about that. Well, this is Git, my friend. So if you've totally ruined a file, you've changed it, you've saved it, you've changed it and then saved it, you've just, you know, it's completely different, right? No worries. All you have to do is do a git space checkout space the name of that file. Restores that file into the previous, to be the exact same as it was for the when you pushed it. It's like magic. It really is. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, especially on web stuff, where I'm trying something new, and in order to try that one new thing, I have to change like 5 different attributes in the style sheet, and maybe move the HTML around in the flow of the HTML document. And by the end, by the time I'm finished, and it didn't work, I've like made all these changes, and what do you do then? Well, in my case, all I do is a git checkout stylesheet.css and a git checkout index.html. And I'm back to my known sort of safe version and can start playing around again. It's amazing. It's so cool. And that's literally it. That's Git for you. It's just that simple and that powerful. So it's really easy to use, and you probably should use it. You owe it to yourself to try it, honestly. It's such a cool system. Git, I may not have mentioned this, but someone in IRC mentioned it to me. I don't know who it was. I kind of do, but I don't want to get the name wrong. And then the cool thing is about Git, there's a little community out there who has been managing their home directories with Git. So you've got your /home/clat2. Well, hopefully you don't have a /home/clat2, but you have a home directory. And they make their whole home directory a Git repository. And they sync it, and that's their backup mechanism. And it sounds amazing, and I'm really, really tempted to try it. I mean, I manage so much stuff anyway at this point that it almost feels silly not to. And yet at the same time, it feels kind of weird to have everything I'm doing in one big Git system. You know, it feels a little bit strange to me. It feels like when you do a Git status or something, it would just be so overwhelming, because I'm sure there would be files that you wouldn't want to track. So maybe you could do like a Git ignore on a certain folder and put all your untracked stuff in there to kind of mitigate it. I don't really know how they're doing it, but it is really an interesting thing, and I am tempted to try it. But either way, Git is an amazing system. It's one of those things, it's one of the technologies in GNU Linux that has really, really changed, like, my life. You know, I mean, it's completely altered the way that I'm able to work, because if I step away from a project for a long time, and I frequently do, you know, I mean, if it's something that takes a long time, like Slacker Media, for instance, I mean, I kind of write on it until it gets current with the current Slackware, and then I kind of walk away from it because I don't really need to do anything with it. It's current. And then I do something like add Qtractor and Kdenlive into the mix or something, and suddenly I'm back in it. And it's really difficult. I mean, it would be difficult for me traditionally to say, okay, this folder labeled Slacker Media Book is the most current up-to-date version of this that I have. And this one on my thumb drive and this one on my laptop, those don't matter. This is the master right here. How do you do that? It's so hard to keep track of that stuff, at least for me. But if I have everything Git pushed, then I don't care. I'll go to any Slacker Media-book folder and do a Git pull, and I'm up to date, and I know I'm up to date, and I can feel good about being up to date, and I don't have to worry about losing work or getting confused between versions or anything like that. So it really has completely changed the way that I work, the way that I write, just everything. It's a completely revolutionary technology to me, and I don't know if that's because it's Git or if it's just because versioning control is so neat. Whatever it is, or both, whatever it is, I really, really like it. So check Git out. Now you know how to set up a personal Git server, so there's really no excuse not to. Well, if I didn't know any better, it sounds like it's time for coffee, so let's go get some coffee and then we'll come back and talk about encrypting thumb drives. Okay, I hope you enjoyed your coffee, because we're about to do something really, really cool. You thought Git was cool? Get a load of this. So I was talking a little bit, I don't even know how it came up, talking a little bit about thumb drives or something. Someone might have mentioned TrueCrypt, I don't really remember, but Jesse James in IRC mentioned, why would anyone do such and such, why don't you just use Lux, L-U-K-S. And I said, well, sure, I'll do that if you tell me how to. And so he did. So now I'm telling you. But this is all Jesse James, and he blew my mind. This is really, really, really cool. So, obviously thumb drives are great. We all love them. I use them all the time. I really do. Because just, if I have two computers, I know for a fact that I'm going to end up working on the same project on both of those computers, whether it's just convenience or whether it's because the laptop suddenly is out of batteries and now I need to switch to a desktop, you know, whatever. Maybe I'm bored somewhere and there's a computer nearby, or I have access to my laptop, whatever. I always use thumb drives. So I don't know how many times it takes, you know, kind of like one of those when you're still kind of acclimating yourself to the concept of backing up, right? How many times does it take you to lose a file or have a scare where your hard drive starts acting a little bit funky and you're like, oh my gosh, just let me get this file and I promise you I will start backing up tomorrow morning. You know, it's always like this bargain with the universe that you try to run. So if it similarly in thumb drives, I think, I mean, if you've got a thumb drive and you're walking home from the cafe and you kind of put your hand in your pocket and you realize, oh my gosh, my thumb drive isn't there. That's the pocket I always put my thumb drive in there, and it's not there. So what do? You panic. You think, I better turn around. I better run back to the cafe. And then suddenly you realize, oh, you just put it in the side pocket of your backpack instead of your pocket where you usually put it, or you put it in your sweater pocket instead of your pants pocket. Whatever. Point is, how many times does it take for you to have that sort of adrenaline rush and sense of dread until you realize that, yeah, I guess if I lost that thumb drive, I would kind of be bummed. So I mitigate that feeling, the sense of losing data, by backing up my thumb drive frequently. I just do it with rsync. I just back it up to a local folder on my computers, and it's just a running rsync. It's something that I just do. And so I've got a rsynced backup of it on my laptop. I've got an rsynced backup of on my workstation. They may or may not be very different. I mean, I feel like it's okay if they're not exactly synchronized. Don't really care so much about that. The really important stuff that I'm actively changing, I use Git to push that to the server wherever it's living. So I feel good about that. I'm fine about that. But I started thinking the other day, wouldn't it be kind of a bummer if I lost my thumb drive and just every file on there was just kind of open to anyone who wanted to use the thumb drive? Well, to be fair, it's not. It would only be open to someone who knows what an EXT2 formatted drive is, because I almost all of my thumb drives are formatted as EXTs, not as FAT or anything like that. So, to be fair, probably most people, if they found it, they would simply erase it and use it. Even so, theoretically speaking, it would be kind of cool to have some encryption going on, I think. And since Jesse James kindly volunteered the information, I figured I might as well learn it. So I did. Took a 2-gig thumb drive, you can try this at home, and plugged it into my computer, obviously do a demessage to make sure that it's mounted where you think it's mounted. It'll typically be dev SDB if it's a laptop, but, you know, it could be anything, obviously. So make sure that you know where it really is mounted, because we're going to destroy this thing. In the process of making it better. So make sure it's empty, you know, the whole nine yards. So it's an empty thumb drive, you know where it's mounted, it's DMESG, and it shows you that, yes, you've just plugged something into dev SDB. Great. Now, you'd be root for this, and you would do a cfdisk /dev/SDB. Or if you want to use fdisk, or whatever you prefer, but I use cfdisk. Delete whatever partition map is on there right now, and then create a new one, and I just make a full partition across the whole thing, and type in yes, or write, rather, and then yes, and then quit. Now you've just made a new partition table, so there's a partition on this little thumb drive. Next step is to do crypt setup, CRYPTSETUP, all one word, crypt setup. Space lux format, that is LUKS format with a capital F, and that's one string, and then space /dev/SDB1, because we're lux formatting the partition, not the thumb drive. You know, it's the partition on the thumb drive. So that's SDB1. So lux format is part of the, I guess, LVM suite, actually, from what I understand, but lux is the cryptography, I guess, file system side of things. I don't know the exact lineage of the project, and I don't really care. All I know is this is really cool. So when you do the lux format, crypt setup space lux format space /dev/SDB1, you'll be prompted, well, first of all, you'll be warned. This is going to destroy this volume. Do you want to do this? You have to enter yes, all in capital letters. Otherwise, it will just bail out. It's kind of nice. And then it will prompt you for a passphrase. So you want to put some kind of passphrase in here. And then you'll verify the passphrase. And that will be the passphrase for that thumb drive. So the usual warnings apply, like, don't forget that because there's no way to get it back, that kind of thing. So now you've done the lux format, you've given a passphrase. Now you do crypt setup space lux open, the capital O. So it's crypt setup space LUKS capital OPEN space /dev/SDB1 space some name. I called it Zippy, but you can call it anything. I don't know why I called it Zippy. It sounded cute. So now you've opened up the Lux partition. You'll have to enter your password, of course, because you're decrypting it now. And you've mounted it into the /dev/mapper. As Zippy. You can call it whatever you want to. You don't have to go with Zippy. But yeah, so that mounts it into the LVM kind of device mapper that you see when you are dealing with LVM volumes. And then you need to place a file system onto that format. This is the step that I'd skipped because I kind of forgot that I hadn't done that yet. And I thought, well, I just created the, you know, I partitioned it. I created the cryptography. I encrypted the partition. Why isn't this working? Well, the thing that isn't working is that there's no file system on there yet. So that's easy enough. It's mkfs.ext2 or ext3, whatever you want, space /dev/mapper/zippy, and that creates a file system on that encrypted partition. Now, if you do an ls space -lh space /dev/mapper, you'll see that the thing that you have created, that little zippy partition or whatever, is actually an alias to some other thing. To find what that thing is, do this ls-lh. It'll show you the symlink, and it will be to something like /dev/dm-probably 0, if this is the first one that you've done. So you've got this new /dev/dm-0, and that's the thing that you can actually mount. So if you do a mount space /dev/dm-0 space /mnt/zip, then, and or floppy, wherever you mount your hard drives manually. Like, I always do it in the /mnt folder into one of the pre-created folders that Slackware provides. Floppy, zip, there's a couple of others. But those are the two that I use because I know for sure I'm not using them for something else. So if you mount it to that, then suddenly you've mounted your thumb drive. And it's decrypted right now. It's in the state of decryption. And so you could write to it. Now what I do is I cd in /mnt/zip, and I make a directory for myself, clat2, and I chone that directory to clat2 and my group, and then there's a folder on that partition that my user can write to, no matter how it gets mounted. But, I mean, that's kind of doing it all manually, and that's to confirm that it's worked and that you can write to it and stuff like that. So go ahead and umount it. Umount /mnt/zip. Well, get out of it first and then umount it. And now take the thumb drive out of the USB port and then plug it back in. And this is really, really cool. This is the part that kind of just blew my mind for some reason. I don't really know why, but when I plugged in the thumb drive, it popped up in my device notifier in KDE. And instead of the normal sort of like little connection looking icon, it had a little lock on it. And I thought, well, that looks pretty promising. And sure enough, it said it was a 1.9 gigabyte encrypted container. And I thought, wow, I've never seen that before. So I clicked the little lock, and it prompted me for a password. And I put in my device's password, and the thing mounted in Dolphin. It just opened up in Dolphin. It was amazing. It was, I mean, complete GUI integration. It's not like you have to do it from the command line every time. You can just, when you mount it, or when you want to decrypt it and mount it, in your desktop, it just comes up just like that. I mean, that's an argument for me, at least, over TrueCrypt right there. I mean, first of all, TrueCrypt, nothing against it. I don't know much about it. I remember I used it a little bit here and there back when I was getting into Unix a little bit. You know, I was more new to it. That was kind of the one that I knew about. And it came in handy. And it was, you know, very cross-compatible, so it was nice. But at this point, I don't need that cross-compatibility so much. I have access to Linux quite sufficiently, so I don't really need that. So being able to just do something that's completely integrated into my normal desktop environment and have it just pop up in the GUI like that and prompt me for a password and just know that it's completely encrypted, that was amazing to me. It was just so smooth and so easy and just really, really cool. So if you've not tried this, you have to try it. It's really cool. Big thanks goes out to Jesse James for sharing that bit of knowledge with me. Would have probably never figured that out. That was one of those things that you just kind of, I think you have to hear about, because there's so many steps to it, and you don't even understand what's going on until you've done it. Then you're like, okay, I get it. That was the encryption container part. Now I'm creating the file system inside of that container. You know, you don't know that stuff unless someone's kind of like talking you through it. So very, very cool trick. Lots of, you know, security and stuff. Try it out. It's really neat. So, yeah, that's encryption of thumb drives. Okay, one last thing, really quick. Like, there is a thing going on called KDE Join the Game. What is Join the Game? Well, it turns out that Join the Game is a money-raising, fund-driving kind of effort on KDE's part to appeal to people, kind of bring them into the community, make them feel involved. And I thought, you know what, I like KDE a lot, and I can't do anything for them because I don't know how to code or anything. I've written a couple of articles for their news feed and stuff like that, but I can't really give anything substantial, and I haven't paid for really anything in a very long time, so why not send them some money? So you can go to Join the Game, I think it's jointhegame.kde.org, and send them money, and they will, and I kind of did that, and I thought, okay, cool, there, I've done my part, yay, and I didn't really give it much of a thought, and then, like, it must have been 2 months later, suddenly I get this package in from Germany, and I had no idea what it was, open it up, and it's this really, really nice little KDE-branded box, and on the inside, it's got this nice little business card type of thing, but it's metal. It's made out of metal, and it says like KDE member or something like that, and has Klaatu on there, and it looks really nice. I have no clue what I'm going to do with it. I'll probably melt it down and sell it or something as scrap metal, but I mean, it's really cool looking, and it's you know, if you're into that sort of thing, then you can send them money, and they do send you a little token of appreciation back. It is really, really nice looking, very smart looking, and it's a good way to support a project. A lot of projects these days are seeming to sort of do the whole fundraising thing, and because I know that money is a very real concern, I mean, it is just something that we kind of right now have to deal with, so it seems like not a bad idea to send the projects that you really use a lot, send them some money. I mean, if you can, obviously. I mean, it doesn't really do you a whole lot of good to send a project money if you're broke, but if you're the type of person who has a little bit of money that you know you can do something with, then supporting the software that you use and making sure that those, I don't know, I think of them as artists, you know. I mean, I like to be patrons of the arts, a patron of the arts to whatever degree I can be. Same way with software, you know, I don't mind at all paying for software that a lot of hard work has gone into and that makes my life immeasurably more enjoyable, so and really much more efficient. So yeah, so just keep that in mind. Jointhegame.kde.org. It's something that exists and something that you can throw money at. So and they'll give you a metal business card in return. So enjoy that, and yeah, it is very nice, by the way. And you get a little cardboard box that says KDE on it, little logo. It's pretty neat. I do believe that is the end of this episode, so thank you very much for listening. You can reach me online via im@notclat2@jabber.org. You can find me on IRC and Freenode Network, usually in the channel Ogcast Planet or Slackware, Slacker Media, someplace like that. My nick on there is notclat2. Email me at klaatu@hackrepublicradio.org or klaatu@member.fsf.org. Doesn't matter, they go to the same place. And of course, you can visit the website at gnuworldorder.info. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.